Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name's Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here with Ian Hislop, Helen Lewis and Adam McQueen. We're here to discuss lots of things that have been happening in the news since the last issue of the magazine was published. But before we begin all that, we have a question to ask of you, our listeners, which is, do you want to know anything from us? There is a podcast email address, which is podcast@private-eye.co.uk. And if you have any questions about anything you've really wanted to know, if you see something in the news and you think, why has that story been published now? You see someone and you think, I wonder if there's anything that legally is safe to say about them that I ought to know.
Or if you want to curry favour with Andy, have you got a question about green issues, perhaps some sort of boiler?
Or if you just want to ask, what's that Ian Hislop off the telly really like? Sure. Everyone, none of us have ever answered that question before. So.
Yes, we're thinking of doing an audience special or just having a few questions each time. So email that address, podcast@private-eye.co.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Right, now, with that done, we should get on to the news of the week. And one of the stories that we wanted to look at, because it relates especially to the eye, is about the murder of the teenager Brianna Gay and the decision, the sentencing by the judge to name her two killers, who were 15 and 16 at the time that Brianna was killed. And this has prompted a lot of confusion and a lot of discussion about what you're allowed to say and when. And Adam, you have been looking into this and, of course, covering stories which have these kind of restrictions for many years.
Yeah, I haven't been covering that particular case or anything, but and it's not really focusing on that. But I just think there's a whole area here which is very, very misunderstood, which is reporting restrictions and, beyond reporting restrictions, just what you are allowed to say and not say when a case is active and going through the court. And it leads to all sorts of conspiracy theories and things, particularly online, which are then exploited by various people. You'll remember a few years ago Tommy Robinson, the EDL guy, being arrested because he was turning up supposedly as a citizen journalist outside courtrooms in the kind of Rochdale and Rotherham grooming scandal trials and claiming, you know, he had rights under freedom of speech and that his freedom of speech were being suppressed and facts were being suppressed and things. So there is a lot of confusion about this and it leads into a lot of kind of nonsense online and elsewhere. What I've done here is I've referred back to, sound effect coming up, this book, which I took down off the shelf in the office that you and I share at Private Eye, Andy, is McNay's Essential Law for Journalists. Now, if there's anything you notice about this book, it's not terribly well thumbed. It doesn't sort of automatically fall open on any particular pages or anything. But no, I've had a read of it today. Fascinating stuff in there. Essentially,
it's 30 years too late.
I was relieved to discover what I remembered, what was the case. So the big thing that happened last week was that the judge in the Brianna Gay case decided to release the automatic reporting restriction on not being able to reveal the identity of the two killers. And that was imposed automatically on the grounds that they were 15 and 16 at the time of the murder. Under 18s, juveniles, as they're referred to in the justice system, get automatic anonymity in all cases like that.
Were you surprised by the judge's decision? Because my memory of this is thinking about the Jamie Bulger case, which is probably the biggest case since involving minors. And since then, it has been very difficult for the killers who have, in one case, coming up for parole hearings and things like that and serving their time, to reintegrate back into normal society because they are essentially infamous. That to me is my concern about the naming of these two young people.
Yeah, you kind of get into a separate issue then, don't you? I mean, we're talking the sentences that have been imposed. These kids are going to be in their 30s at the point when they are released. And at that point, I would guess that the decision will be taken as it was in the cases of John Venables and Robert Thompson to give them new identities. That's got to be balanced, of course, by judges in different cases with the kind of public interest in making details known and in the naming of people.
Do judges need to provide reasons why they're naming killers in cases? Was there a justification given on this occasion?
It's the other way round, isn't it? You have to provide a justification for not naming people in most cases. I mean, when it's minors, obviously, it's different. But the principle is open justice unless there is some reason not to.
The principle generally in law is that you don't make what they call derogations from open justice unless it's absolutely justified under certain circumstances.
Okay.
Isn't it, in a sense, adding to the sentence given? You will go away for this number of years. During that number of years, you will be known in prison as the child killer, so that will make your sentence worth. And at the end of your sentence, the tabloids will insist that you don't come out. Whatever the rights and wrongs of that is being added in by allowing the names to come forward.
So, sorry, what has Tommy Robinson got to do with all of this?
That kind of brings me back to where I started with this, which is the way that what you are and aren't allowed to say at a report. And the basic rule of this, just so, because I don't think this is something that, that people outside of the media or outside of the legal system are necessarily aware of, is that you cannot put anything into the public domain that is not being put before the jury in a criminal trial. And that includes all of those, and this was the stuff that came out last week in the very, very good summing up of the sentencing remarks by the judge. Included all sorts of stuff that was heard at pre-trial hearings, which are completely covered again by reporting restrictions right up until the conclusion of a trial. And the reason for that is quite often that there are all sorts of back and forth arguments between prosecution and defence over related issues and evidence that may or may not be put in front of the jury, which obviously is completely negated if they're out there in the, you know, any previous convictions or anything are out there in the media, then any jury coming in are potentially going to have read that and know about that. But also quite often, and this was something that Tommy Robinson kind of exploited in those grooming cases, you get an awful lot of interrelated cases, people who are up on a lot of charges. And a lot of the other horse trading that goes on at pre-trial stuff between prosecution and defences is what cases are going to be heard together, what cases are going to be separated out. And if they are separated out into separate cases, which may be heard months or even years apart, you have to hold stuff back so it doesn't prejudice a potential trial, because everyone has the right to a fair trial and an unprejudiced trial, you know, whether they are found innocent or guilty at the end of it. So the answer, it's very easy to kind of make conspiracy theories out of all of these things, especially if you're someone online who's just bashing whistling. Well, I found this out, and why are we not being told this?
There is very confusing.
It's a very boring and procedural a reason, usually. And the other thing, I mean, two other things that listeners will have seen in court reports and maybe wondered about what was going on. That irritating phrase they always have to put on there saying, the case continues. This is because you have to give a fair and accurate, also contemporaneous report on proceedings. So you have to, even as you were saying, you know, and it may be the day that the prosecution is putting their evidence and everything in your report, everything that you then report that has been said in the courtroom makes the defendant look completely bang to rights. You have to kind of cage that in the context of this is an ongoing trial, there's a load of other evidence as well, which isn't necessarily how people are going to read it, but you have to kind of make it obvious to readers.
Can I say this is one of the problems with reading court reports now, because of cuts on local journalism and reporting, is you tend to get the case for the prosecution because it's on the first day and the reporters turned up and you think, well, they're bang to rights, and they're not there on the other days, or the editor doesn't put it in, so you don't hear the other side. And the case does continue, but it's not covered.
The second thing that people may be intrigued by and not aware of is that these rules about not prejudicing trials kick in from the moment a case is active, which is defined as the moment when someone is arrested. So, for instance, as we speak, the suspect in that horrible Alkali attack in Clapham is still on the loose, being searched for by police, and we're here reading all sorts of details about him. Should he get arrested and charged, you're suddenly going to read an awful lot less until he comes to trial. And I think that's another thing that people don't quite understand, was why something can be an enormous news story and then suddenly just disappear off the agenda completely.
That's a very good point. You're right, because it feels like an eerie chill has descended. Like, why is no one talking about it?
As a reader, you're just like, why? That's when we get those things saying, is there a super injunction? No. Is there a D notice?
No.
And there is another problem I have to say with this, is if there are specific reporting restrictions are put in for the reasons we've been discussing of related trials or anything like that, it's quite hard to find out about those unless you are actually a journalist down there in the court and hear the discussions of it and get the actual order put through to you. I've got to say, I mean, Old Bailey cases and things, they're really pretty good on this. And judges' clerks are very, very helpful. And, you know, it's in their interest to get that stuff out so as the entire trial isn't prejudiced and thrown out, has to be heard again. But it is a lot more difficult in kind of Crown Courts, magistrates' courts around the country. Which used to be covered, you know, there would be a standard, if not someone from an agency, someone from a local paper would be down there covering these things.
So what you're saying here is that reporting restrictions are basically not a bad thing. It can in fact be a sign of health that the case is going to be dealt with properly.
The conspiracy theorising, I think, is really troublesome, because you mentioned Tommy Robinson there, and one of the things, as you say, he stood up on the steps at grooming trial and said essentially, this is not getting on the BBC, you're not hearing about this because it's all just covering up of these pedos and it's all a big establishment conspiracy. And not only did the reporting restrictions prevent you saying that, but the reporting restrictions prevent you saying we have to keep quiet because these people are on trial for other things. That is in itself prejudicial. And I think the other problem that comes up here is America and like the American internet, because the American system is so completely different. The idea there is you can publish basically whatever you like and the juries just shouldn't read it. And I think so if you're particularly if you're a younger person who's, you know, been absolutely hooked on the Johnny Depp trial via TikTok, where it's all televised, you hear absolutely everything, you can hear any commentary you want all the way through, you assume that there is something weird and sinister going on in the British system rather than it just having a very different attitude to how sequestered the juries should be expected to be.
And flipping it the other way, the relief from media organisations when there's a high-profile trial abroad. I always remember Oscar Pistorius' murder trial and this realisation in newsrooms that actually they have completely different contempt of court laws over in South Africa. And actually, we can pretty much say what we want here. It was absolutely extraordinary.
Mm. I mean, and as an editor, I mean, you're worried about contempt from a general and moral point of view, that you don't want to prejudice someone else's trial, but also if it's someone whose trial you want to see go down by getting done for contempt, you may well scupper the entire trial and nothing will happen. So you do have to be incredibly careful, and I say this because I've had various problems with contempt, not having read that book sufficiently closely.
We have got someone around this table with some expertise in this area.
Yes,
do we not?
But only on the wrong side. But I would say that recently the Eye has attempted to challenge a number of reporting restrictions. So we don't always accept them. I mean, on the whole, and particularly in the cases you've mentioned and the precedent, I totally get it. But there are cases where I get an order and think, this is too harsh, we will try and do this. And we did this recently in the Lucy Letby trial, and we contested an order along with a number of three or four other media organisations, and they said the order was indeed too restrictive, but the basic contempt with her retrial, even though her appeal's been turned down, remains. So we are not allowed to run the pieces that we thought of running. I accept that. But I'm just saying it is challengeable. It is not a great, there's some vast conspiracy going on. There isn't. I don't happen to agree with the order, but I do get it.
This stuff is always challengeable, and it is challenged constantly. You will have regular breaks in trials where any sort of reporting restrictions are discussed and challenged, and KC is usually brought in on behalf, usually of several different media organisations. I'd say BBC is usually one of them because they're quite hot on these things.
And the Mail and the Telegraph do as well, right? Yeah. I think that's one of the things when people talk about the decline of journalism is it takes a huge amount of resources to employ a KC to challenge reporting restrictions. Fundamentally, as a local paper, even that's going to be quite challenging. It's big, well-resourced media organisations that can actually do that.
And when you challenge the order, the defence KC is brought in, and the prosecution KC. So it's no good you saying, "Well, I want this done in the interests of justice." The person who's representing the person who's seeking justice may say, "Well, I don't want your input. I would like to fight this trial. Thank you very much." And that can happen both ways. So it's not nothing happens. I mean, behind the scenes, as you say, people are trying to make these orders work.
That's one other thing, actually, to bring up. I mean, maybe another thing that's confused readers in the past is when perpetrators of child sex abuse retain anonymity even after being convicted. And quite often that is a case of, because victims of sexual abuse and sexual crimes get automatic anonymity for life, a lot of sexual abuse takes place within families. If you are
if it's their dad, revealing
that is going to reveal the identity of the victim. So again, that's one of those things that can look very confusing and very conspiracy theory worthy, but actually has a fairly straightforward and rather horrible explanation. If you're feeling slightly confused by this, listeners, don't worry, because a lot of journalists are as well. It was a guy we had in on work experience who has now gone on to great things in journalism. I'm not going to name him here, but subsequent to doing work experience with us, I checked in on him a couple of weeks later and said, how are you getting on now? And he'd gone on to a work experience placement on a national newspaper website where there was, I can't even remember which one it was, but a very big high-profile trial going on at the time. And the night news editor, the person who was in charge of the website overnight, had come up to him and said, "That's amazing stuff I found online about the guy who's on trial. It's really amazing. And it's not been reported anywhere. We've got an exclusive on this I'm going to put up." And our workie, who at that point was kind of like 22, and fresh out of university, had to say to him, "That would be rather unwise." And explain the concept of contempt of court to him.
And can I just say that, despite Adam's enthusiasm for the American courts, because you can suddenly write about everything, if you watch the behaviour of Donald Trump, the idea that some sort of contempt law would not help when the defendant literally comes out and says, I won the previous case, when he's in the middle of a trial for another case. No, you didn't, actually, but it doesn't matter. You can say it.
And there is the problem that, yeah, I think the Johnny Depp Amber Heard case is a very good example of it. Just becomes a kind of really horrible circus in which you are essentially on a much more ongoing basis in a kind of court of public opinion. I mean, the OJ trial being another really obvious example of that, and the way that it becomes kind of picked clean by everybody in a way that I think probably discourages people from going to the police, actually. So, yeah, these are a difficult balance to strike, I guess.
Is there one more thing that you wish more people or more readers knew about the system, the reporting restriction, the legal restrictions that would make your inboxes easier places so you didn't have so many people saying, why are you not covering this?
I would say, as an editor, the assumption by a reader saying, I assume you are part of this conspiracy and that they have got to you. The big conspiracy amongst sort of the press is they'd like to put stories in. They're constantly conspiring to get information into the public domain. Sadly, the opposite isn't really true.
Yeah, I think the real problem is lack of resourcing in journalism to get someone, as Ian was saying, into the second day, the third week, the eighth week of the trial. That's the real... The conspiracy is of lack of money in order to report things fully so that, you know, if you have a guy who is a serial crook in your community and keeps starting businesses, it needs to be in the local paper that he's doing this because he probably will do it again. And it's really... Like, it's really important that you know that. So that's the thing I wish people knew, is that it's a resource problem, not a kind of evil.
That in
problem.
Most cases, the reason that the media is not reporting something is that they don't actually know about it.
Right.
And actually, just instead of sending them an email saying, why aren't you covering this, you idiots, why are you covering up? Sending them one saying, did you know this case was going on? And maybe they can then get someone down to the courtroom and cover it.
Okay. Well, having been so very nice about journalists, we should now move on to another story, which is about journalists changing careers and the sort of rather permeable membrane that has suddenly opened between the worlds of journalism and politics. And everyone is wincing at that phrase, and I'm going to stand by it. recently, Paul Waugh of The Eye, political editor, very well respected, 20 years experience.
Not The Eye, I. The other I.
Sorry.
Irritatingly named.
The letter I. I. Paul Waugh, nothing to do with private eye, announced that he was going to throw his hat in the ring to become the Labour candidate after it was
Rochdale, after the death of Tony Lloyd.
Yeah, Lloyd had died. And as it happens, he did not get selected as the candidate. I don't know if it was a surprise to him or not, but obviously he had to basically junk his career at The Eye in order to stand, which was a sort of 6-day journey into the world of politics for him, and now he's not going to be able to do that again.
That's a quicker career than Liz Truss.
But this has been happening more and more, I think.
One of the things that's very interesting is the fact that obviously politics is quite badly paid, and so is journalism now. So these are the two. You know, if you run a high flying city consultancy, maybe you don't want to become an MP. But it's not that much of a trade down if you're a journalist. And Paul Waugh is an interesting example of someone, as you say, very well respected. People, I think, genuinely did not know what his politics were before he did this. So when he kind of came out as being Labour, that was quite a big surprise.
No, it wasn't just he came out as being Labour. He was quite far left Labour, wasn't he?
Well,
kind of on the more Corbyn-y end.
Yeah, the endorsement from John McDonnell, I admit, was a surprise from me. And then he did send a text message out to all of the selectors, of whom there are only a couple of hundred, saying, by the way, I think we should call for a ceasefire in Gaza, which is very popular among particularly Muslim Labour members, right? This has been a big source, a running sore with Keir Starmer, because he won't do it. And lots of people in the party want him to do it. So, yeah, so some of that is, you know, what you need to kind of say to with the selectorate that you're faced with. But the interesting thing is, as you say, he became a candidate on the sort of Saturday, sent out all his stuff on the Wednesday, and then by the next Saturday morning he was chucked aside again, which is
political Craig David.
I was going to say Craig Oliver, but no, actually a worse Craig than Craig Oliver. So it's a really, this candidate selection is a really brutal process, and I think you have to understand it if you want to understand it, why we get the MPs that we do. Isabel Hardman of The Spectator wrote a brilliant book called Why We'd Get the Wrong Politicians. And she did a survey on that in which I think the average candidate spends about £30,000 on getting selected and then campaigning. And now that is regardless of whether they get selected or not. You still have to spend a lot of money, right? You have to give up your job. And so who are the people who run to become MPs? Well, they're usually people who can get time off from their other pursuits. So trade union officials, special advisors. And as it turns out, journalists or think tanky aligned journalists. So the two other kind of examples of this everyone talks about are Seb Payne, who went from The Spectator to the FT to Onward, the think tank, and has so far been unsuccessful. Yeah. And then poor old Paul Mason, who had a kind of great kind of rebirth, I think, during the kind of Greek financial crisis, where he suddenly became very passionate about left-wing causes and bought a lot of leather jackets. And
that was kind. I was going to go with midlife crisis, but you served that. That's good.
We all have them. They just come in different forms. And then spend a lot of time trying to get selected during the kind of Corbyn years, but really essentially fell out with the core of them. But I think what's really interesting about both, in the case of both Paul Mason and Seb Payne, is how humiliating a process of it. There's literally a Twitter account that is called something like, "Has Seb Payne been selected yet?" Because you are really out on your own during that bit. You do not have the party machinery behind you. It's a really tough thing for anyone. I'm not sure anyone would go through it.
Does this book suggest that we get a low quality of MP because they're journalists or think tank members or local councillors or trade union officials? Is the suggestion we'd get a better class of MP if the system was more kindly and less expensive?
Yeah. You would get a more normal kind of MP. I mean, how on earth, if you're a supermarket checkout worker or a call centre worker or even a teacher without trade union official links, do you get that kind of time off and the money that you need to do that? I think at the last count, only 4% of MPs had formerly worked in manual occupations, so what you would have traditionally called working class. And so you're right, we're just excluding whole swathes of people from selection just because they can't afford to do it, basically.
Should it be like jury service, that if you want to stand as an MP, you have to be given your job back at the end?
Oh, I like that. I thought you would say it was jury service in the sense that someone just tells you you have to be an MP for a bit now, and you kind of like, you try and say, but I've got a very important job already.
Well, that's not a bad idea either.
It's very Athenian, I suppose, in that sense. But yeah, I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, but I struggle with the idea of journalists moving into politics and moving back out of politics. So one of the people who has been successful, for example, is Nick Timothy, formerly of the Rasputin-bearded Theresa May's co-chief of staff. He's been selected for Matt Hancock's old seat in West Suffolk. And he is both the prospective Conservative candidate and also a columnist at the Daily Telegraph. And you think, well, you know, am I getting your honest opinion or what you think you need to say in order to get a Tory government back in? To me, that's the problem. I mean, I know columnists are very different from news reporter, but I just think the two roles are kind of incompatible.
Yes, and the Gove example is, he's been through the membrane both ways, hasn't he? I'm never sure whether he's stuck in the middle of it.
Yeah, I mean, in the various cabinets that we've had that he's been in and out of, he's gone back to Murdoch every single time. Do you remember?
He did the Trump interview with the thumbs up picture.
Yeah. And then sort of was twanged back into the cabinet within the month, I think.
The permeable membrane was like a knicker elastic.
I really liked Ian's idea there of saying, you know, it should be like jury service and you should have, by law, to have your job held open for you if you don't make it. And then I just thought, but absolutely not if you're a journalist. And actually, I think that was the decision that Ollie Duff, the editor of The Eye, made, and I think Paul Waugh agreed with, was that there is absolutely no way that whatever had happened, he could come back to a job as a chief political commentator, which is, you know, it's not being an opinionated columnist. It's something slightly different.
So, sorry, can we just draw that out a bit? Because I think the differentiation is an important one to focus on. So you're saying that they're completely incompatible, Helen?
I don't think you can be a news reporter and be a parliamentary candidate or seeking parliamentary selection. So there was a big backlash, quite subdued backlash, when Sebastian Payne was still at the FT, when everyone thought, but you're a Conservative. You know, he was a leader writer. And it was like, well, we've got someone in here who's just, you know, is a Conservative partisan. They're not just somebody who's got right-wing inclinations. They want a particular party to win. And some journalists take this even further. Sam Coates of Sky News said he doesn't vote, right? He just, he thinks actually you should completely stand back from...
That was always Jeremy Paxman's position as well.
Yeah, and I can really see the point of that. If you don't, you shouldn't kind of as a journalist be going in hoping for one side or the other to win.
Even though almost everyone probably does. It's very difficult to maintain a complete civil service style neutrality. I mean, civil servants have political thoughts and leanings and inclinations. It's probably why they go into, you know, politics adjacent careers in the first place. But you have to have a structure in place so that you're not expressing those views.
You're saying that from the luxury of working for a satirical magazine, where at least we can always console ourselves by thinking, well, there'll be some good jokes, there'll be some good covers, won't there? There's at least that.
Well, no, I'm saying it's because I should have mentioned this to you guys earlier. I've thrown my hat in the ring for the Reform Party for the next election, and I just, you know, I hope that won't be a problem, Ian.
No, it isn't a problem. You're fired. But yeah. This is presumably because we write about GB News all the time. It is the same problem that as broadcasters, they're Tory MPs.
Yeah.
And I feel with op-ed and columnists, if they're regular and they're about to be an MP, or they've just been one, or they're hoping to be one again, you're not getting the full picture. And certainly with Nick Timothy, I'm, again, you're very generous to say someone had done this successfully. I think they've manoeuvred successively. But when I read his opinions on the Theresa May premiership, I think, yeah, but you were there. You were the right-hand person. You're not really allowed to say this because you've done this once badly.
Mm.
But I mean, it's, he at least, as you say, is a columnist. I mean, The Express yes. currently has, as I think, his deputy political editor, Asa Bennett, who was Liz Truss's speechwriter, which is, you'd think, would be a hindrance on your CV rather than anything else. But no, straight back in.
That is the weird thing about the membrane and the way it's, because so many MPs now, as we've discussed lots before, going to places like GB News or Talk TV, have got into politics first, and then they've leveraged that into successful broadcast careers.
It's not so much a revolving door now, it's just this porous thing.
It's just a swimming pool. The problem is, well, or the question is, which of these two fields is more glamorous and desirable? You know, is it? I mean, obviously,
this is
neither.
Like
obviously
choosing
neither.
Between slugs and snails.
I know. But what I'm saying is,
I think they're both below a state agency. Let's not kid ourselves.
But if you are going from one to the other, you're presumably thinking that one is more desirable than the other. Which do we want to be more impressive? Public service in the political realm, or holding, you know, power to account in the journalistic realm? Is one of them more valuable than the other, or should they just be kept apart because they are doing different things?
I think that's the problem. I think people see them as you know, we say the war is the continuation of diplomacy by other means. I think they sort of think like writing a Telegraph op-ed is the continuation of being a Conservative candidate by other means.
But it's bad for both sides because it means the newspaper gets this rump of right-wing Tory MPs who think they are the majority, which there's not a great deal of evidence for this. So the newspapers become more and more out of touch with the people beyond there, so no one buys them anymore and they complain. And it becomes, not separating these roles becomes a problem. And if you look at Leanderson's behaviour, part of me cannot help thinking, if he wasn't on 100 grand a year from GB, he might be less cavalier about resigning from the cabinet. I mean, these are important considerations.
Yeah. I should say I have less of a problem when people aren't directly reporting on politics. I think that's the issue, is that you're kind of trying to ride two horses at once. There is a former FT journalist, Yuan Yuang, who was in the FT China Bureau, who is now left. She's now the Labour candidate for Early and Woodley. And that seems to be less of, I can't imagine that there's that many things that you cover as the China correspondent that are going to be, you know, happening in the unless right. Early and Woodley's got strong opinions about the CCP and they're involved in a huge investment project to build a roundabout there or something. But I think the thing that I think is that it's the direct swish between being a political writer and being a politician, both playing on the pitch and commentating on the match and like running off from going, well, that was a very good goal, wasn't it, that I just scored?
But seeing Leanderson being interviewed by Christopher Hope on GB News, I can't tell who's who or representing who anymore.
Right, or
really
Nigel
can't.
Farage going to the PopCon conference this week to report on it for GB News at the same time that people are saying, is that the kind of, you know, oh, might he join it? Oh, it's very exciting. And if you see it in the US too, you know, you had all the things that came out in the Dominion lawsuit of Fox News stars texting Trump's chief of staff to sort of strategize with him about how he was going to react to the insurrection in the Capitol. Like, it's your job to give political advice to a politician rather than to tell your viewers and readers what it is that they're doing.
It was also Nigel Farage's excuse why he turned up at the Tory party conference last year, wasn't it? He was in a journalistic capacity from his role at GB News and then just became the entire story of the Conservative Party conference. At which point, if you actually were a journalist and had any sort of vaguest sort of ethics that any of us might even try to profess, then you'd kind of think, no, I've got to butt out here.
Is Dancing with Liz Truss in that essential
for journalism? I think it might be one of the appendices.
And why is it called PopCon?
Well, it's like a punchline. It's like they've done the punchline already, right? Popular Conservatives. You're like, I don't think you are. I mean,
you cannot say that Liz Truss did not give a bloody good go to being an unpopular Conservative. So it's about time she tried something else.
The best thing about that is they kicked out Simon Clarke from being allowed to attend, right? He got told on Twitter that he wasn't going to be able to go because he called for Rishi to go. And that apparently is not what the Popular Conservatives, whose entire project is dedicated to bringing down Rishi, saying he's crap. No, that's not what they're all about. Mm-hmm. Don't say it out loud, Simon. What are you doing?
And this problem you read about in the Eye all the time, and you know, it's why we ended up in front of various committees talking about the role of second jobs and vetting people when they go between jobs, is ACOBA, which is meant to sort these things out, is notoriously toothless and essentially allows a lot of this to happen in ways that we think are very unhealthy.
So now we come to something which was in the last issue of The Ike briefly, but which is part of a broader trend, which I thought would be interesting to discuss. It's, again, something slightly to do with the membrane.
You're going to have to call this podcast Insane in the Membrane, achieving a long-held ambition of mine.
There's the title. This was a story about Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves, and it was that she'd had breakfast at Davos. That wasn't the story. It was that the breakfast had been hosted by a crypto asset exchange called Coinbase. So they facilitate the trade of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and so on.
You don't need to explain this stuff, Andy. I don't know who you think's listening to this podcast.
Ian's got huge Ethereum holdings. He knows all about this
I'm
already.
I'm sorry, absolutely. Okay, so it was, but she basically was slightly, if not getting into bed with, certainly sitting down on the sofa with.
It was a breakfast meeting. It wasn't a pre-breakfast.
Sharing a croissant with. That had also been organised by a crypto investor who was called Sriram Krishnan. And Coinbase are in various amounts of legal trouble in the USA, so there is something to question there, certainly. And the interesting thing about it is that there is a huge number of MPs, current and former, and particularly former ministers or former chancellors or prime ministers, who have been doing lots of work with crypto firms. So George Osborne, podcaster and actually former chancellor, fun fact.
It's a lot of jobs ago, though, wasn't it? It's about 100 jobs back.
That's true. Well, as chancellor, he was quite interested in crypto, and as a private equity dude, he invested in various crypto things, and now he is advising Coinbase, who are currently halfway through being sued by the SEC in the USA because they've been accused of avoiding various disclosure requirements and failing to register in the correct ways. Now, he says there's a huge amount of exciting innovation in finance right now, and I don't know whether his podcast will be covering that soon, but that's Reeves, Osborne, Philip Hammond.
Yes.
You may not be aware, if you're listening, is now the chair of cryptocurrency firm Copper.
Yes.
And he was written up last year for having arranged, or certainly phoned up, Treasury officials to discuss maybe whether the Treasury would like to meet with people from the crypto world to discuss how marvellous cryptocurrencies are. It was after his 2 years had lapsed. Ian, you were just mentioning Akoba about, you know, how that, so, you know, you're not meant to lobby anyone on behalf of whoever you're working for 2 years. That had all elapsed, so technically perfectly proper.
Magically slate white clean.
But it's got a great ending, this story, is that his intervention was in the hope that Copper would be based in Britain, and he failed, and they're now based in Switzerland.
Yep.
So I would just say to all you cryptos out there, don't hire former politicians. They couldn't run the economy in Britain, let alone your complex, difficult attempts to get around the regulator. Make more money for yourselves.
I think that is the point to say about this. What crypto's got is a lot of money sloshing around it. What it has not got is a lot of credibility. So they are very keen to buy in people who you've heard of in order to put a kind of front on it. So Nigel Farage was pushing it in his Fame and Fortune newsletter.
You've just disproved your own theory.
Well, which is why the kind of whole debanking row was very useful to crypto people, because they're like, why, this is what, you know, the government can't take your money away from you.
Do you want to hear his exact words about it? He said, if you live in a cashless society, as we increase do, you have lost your personal sovereignty, and it's actually much better to have a stash of bitcoins in a crypto wallet than it is to live under the thumb of a central bank digital currency, which is what we all spend and earn. Well, the thing about cryptocurrencies is that they're harder to trace, they're much more international, they're much less regulated, so there are various reasons why you might want to use them, but there are also various reasons why you might want to use them for the purposes of
buying drugs on the internet,
fraud, terrorism, that kind of thing.
And you're against that. All this, are you?
I'm sold, man. I'm well up for that. Yeah,
typical woke Andy against a light bit of drug laundering.
Oh god, are there people selling heat pumps?
But that's the interesting thing. And the question now is what you do with this huge volatile elephant in the room of the world financial system of cryptocurrency, because lots of people agree they need some regulation. Regulation sort of brings them inside the tent and makes them look maybe more respectable than they are. Because the fact is, they're not as safe as houses. They're not very secure. The price fluctuates wildly.
But there's no deposit protection for a start.
Right.
If you have your money in a British bank up to whatever it is, £80,000, then you have, you know, they have to make sure that that doesn't go away. However, you know, I've interviewed people who lost their kids' college funds. This was in America, and that's tough. You know, if the exchange gets hacked, tough. If Sam Bankman-Fried turns out to have spent it all on perm oil and, you know, buying houses in the Bahamas, tough. Like, no one is coming to save you. So the kind of the libertarian love of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, which is about this freedom from control, it also means a freedom from any kind of safety net. So it is an incredibly speculative investment.
Yeah.
And it's one, you know, that has... You know, Bitcoin in particular, the curve is upwards, but with huge corrections downwards. You know, it quite regularly drops by very large amounts of money. And I'm sort of fascinated by, I mean, I imagine they've given George Osborne an enormous amount of money, but he is basically saying this is a real financial product. And I don't know what the consumer protections are for, you know, if you're a sort of 60 something person who is being told that being pushed on you, are you actually getting all the information you want about how little protection there is?
Well, no, you're not. That's a really interesting thing. So the FCA, they have identified loads of problems because last year there was a slight tweak. So crypto promotions now do fall under the FCA's remit. They don't protect people's assets, but they do sort of regulate those promotions. They identified the problems such as, I'm quoting here, risk warnings not being visible enough due to small fonts. which private eye readers will be very familiar with already. Hard to read colouring or non-prominent positioning. I mean, they basically don't tell you that you might lose everything here. So that's the problem.
It's not high tech in the way they're calling people.
No, there are various other problems. The problem is not just the size of the funds. But the other, you know, another organisation looking into this, the Treasury Select Committee, so cross-party committee, they were looking into crypto and they released a report about it last year saying that effectively these should be considered gambling. Their recommendation is that these be regulated like gambling rather than as a financial
service.
But that's
because the people on the Treasury Select Committee haven't yet got jobs at Coinbase. I mean, it's all very well for them to do this sort of boy crying wolf nonsense. But just give them a few years and they'll come round.
It's kind of like that. I mean, they said these things serve no useful social purpose. It's pretty clear.
What, the MPs on the Select Committee?
No.
Sorry, it was right there.
It was right there. And there's now a kind of list of, I'd say, it's probably nearly getting on for a dozen MPs who, I mean, Matt Hancock, we know, takes about...
Hancock got £11,000 to attend the permissionless conference in Florida. Now,
exactly.
If there isn't everything about that sentence says, don't put your money there, do not do it. Yeah.
Yeah, Boris Johnson has taken office.
Well, Boris Johnson went to he went to Singapore to give a speech. And the thing I quite appreciated that, he gave basically the speech that I would give to a crypto thing, which was basically he doesn't really know anything about it and actually thinks it might be a bad thing. So all of his comments were like, well, you know, you have to look into this. It could be tricky, which I imagine introduced a whole load of new Singaporean people to the concept that Boris Johnson doesn't do his homework and just turns up and says something.
I think it was the standard after dinner speech, but for about... goodness knows how much.
Pepper the piggy bank?
Are all of these politicians being paid in Bitcoin or are they being paid in pound sterling?
A lot. The register of members' interest, I think, is in pound sterling. I don't think they've yet I don't think they've yet launched an exchange mechanism.
That is a brilliant question.
Tell you a lot, doesn't it? Really?
Yeah. It's the story about at the end of the war in Blackpool, one of our leading patriotic singers and entertainers was offered her fee and she said, "I'll have it in dollars." Check.
If you would like, I have compiled an up-to-date list of George Osborne's jobs, which if you get all of them right, I will buy a cake for the office.
Between us.
Wow. Okay, I've got seven of them listed here. I'm going to need all seven from you.
Okay, Roby Warshaw Investment Bank. Sorry, I'm picking the low-hanging fruit.
Right,
British Museum.
Yeah, chair of the British Museum, yeah.
I'm a podcaster.
The most important of his jobs, podcaster.
The rest is Ballsbourne. Yeah, yeah. Wow. Okay.
Three.
He has this private equity thing with his brother, I think. It's called Nine Yards.
Don't know what you're... But he's chair of Lingotto Investment Management now.
Okay.
Yeah, that's nice.
I'm pretty sure he did my Amazon delivery the other
day. Venture Capital, sorry. Nine Yards Capital is his firm.
He is also a visiting fellow of the Hoover Institute and a visiting professor at Stanford and president of the Northern Powerhouse Partnership.
Still.
Forgotten about that. Yeah.
I think everyone had, which is why he's probably forgotten to like, log
what
on.
What are
to
they doing now? Just meeting up every couple of months going, bloody HS2 cancel, bloody hell.
Well,
you'd look at those jobs, wouldn't you? And you'd think, in charge of a currency, Osborne Sterling. No, we don't want him in that. British Museum, in charge of what? Losing things and not noticing. Probably not for him. How does he get these jobs?
I love him. He's a great podcaster. I'll say that for him.
Business, journalism and government is what Coinbase said they'd employed him for his experience in.
Right.
Business journalism.
Business, comma, journalism and
remember
government.
He was actually editor of the Evening Standard. You probably erased that from your memory, but he's
no, 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 I do remember that because I can remember the text you sent me on the day that he was appointed, which said, what is going on? What is happening?
It's the fact that George Osborne was a journalist for all of about, what, 19 months and already a more successful journalist than me.
Not a better journalist,
thank
though,
you,
I have
you,
to say.
Thank you, Adam.
He was appointed by Lord Lebedev.
As was I to Private Eye, you just don't know it. I'm his mole.
If we're talking about the membrane, then George Lebedev, I mean, they all move through it.
Yeah, they do, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. But the crypto firms will be, I don't think they have actually asked if they can invest in Private Eye yet, have they, Ian?
No, I think the number of adverts for shitcoin, Britcoin, gnomecoin, and other suggestions that really this is just a Ponzi coin. And no one has yet answered that very effectively.
There is one other thing we should say before we close, which is that the nominations process for the Paul Foote Award this year is now open.
And can I say, as a segue, if you're looking for responsible financial management, previously the prize was £5,000. The prize for the Paul Foote Award is now £8,000. Talk about hyperinflation. It's going mad here at the Eye. £8,000. And for the runner-up, it's £1,500. We're looking for quality journalism, but just remember the prize money.
And it's paid in sterling, not Bitcoin. That's not why it's gone. It hasn't just come down again.
You'll have to fly to Geneva to collect it from Philip Hammond himself. Yeah. No, it is open. And if you're listening to this and you're an investigative journalist and you've got a story that you're especially proud of, go to the Private Eye website, apply. It is a fantastic prize to win. This could be the making of you.
Last year's winner, irresponsible piece of journalism about Michelle Moan. I've no idea how that got through. And that story died.
Yeah. Apply now.
Well, or realistically, the date is 26th of March. So if you're a journalist, that's probably the day you'll apply on.
Oh, fine. You've got weeks. Don't worry about it. You've still got time to write the story. No, I think actually you haven't got time to write the story anymore. But no, it's a fantastic prize. You get to go to a lovely party. Send in your application now. The judges are waiting.
That's your most light entertainment bit yet.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Call now while stocks last.
Right, that's it from this episode of Page 94. Thank you so much for listening. We do hope you've enjoyed it. As I said at the start, if you've got any questions, comments, queries, praise, we accept undiluted praise, send it to podcast@private-eye.co.uk. And if you're listening on Spotify, you can actually send in your question right now via the app. So give that a go. Or go to the magazine's website and pick up your subscription now. It's a great magazine. Right, that's it. Bye for now.
It's a great magazine. We should have that on the cover.
Yeah, that's what the Sunday Times themselves said. It was a smart and witty podcast.
Right.
If you need to ask for more than
there
that,
there are episodes.
There are episodes, they said, and there are many, and there will be more. See you next time. Bye now.